Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour editorial review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and editorial review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Israel's tribes today when we come back. You know, marriage is a state-licensed business. It's a three-party limited general partnership between you, your spouse, and the state. And like any other state-licensed enterprise, it's regulated by the Welfare Department, the Department of Family Services, and the Family Court. Now, the best part about all of this is that you have no input into or say-so over the marriage, divorce, dissolution, custody, alimony, child support, or protective custody or restraining orders. But you get to pay for all of it. And if you fail to pay, you go to jail. Now, marriage is the most important and it's the most expensive contract that you can engage in. It's more binding and it's more costly than your military enlistment or your 30-year home mortgage, but you probably know a whole lot less about that marriage contract than you do about your military obligation or your house payments. And 67% of all marriages in the United States end in divorce. But whether you are a husband or a wife, you do have rights, privileges, and immunities to advance, to protect, or to defend against any breach of this marriage contract. And that's why you should know and understand the terms and conditions of your marriage contract before you marry. And you should write that contract instead of letting the state write it for you. Now, whether you're married or not, why don't you write for my free general law CD package and let me share some vital information with you about the law and that marriage contract. Just call direct 417-273-4967 and ask for the general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. That's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were reviewing a book called Israel's Tribes Today. It's written by a guy named Stephen M. Collins. Collins has written five books now on the history of Israel. He's probably the number one authority, I would say, at this juncture of time. There were a couple of guys that had written books about Israel, or those 10 tribes. A guy by the name of J.H. Allen wrote one back in 1907. Herbert Armstrong wrote one back in the 50s or 60s. And they were good. They gave you a lot of good information, identified most of the tribes. But Collins has taken that a step further. He's written five books. One of them is called The Lost 10 Tribes of Israel Found. He identified the countries that they're in today. And then he wrote a history of Israel. It's called Israel's Lost Empires and Parthia, two books on the history that goes back, to King David and Solomon back in about 1000 B.C. And then took a look at the history along with Barry Fell, the Epigraphic Society, and others, and identified the Israelites here in North America as early as the time of King David and Solomon. And identified the names of the countries or the names of the people, like the Saki and the Parthians and so on, that they were going under, so that you could identify them in secular history. And then he took it through secular history and tells a hell of a story. Now, this last book, Israel's Tribes Today, takes it a step further, and he's going through the nations and identifying the characteristics that we see in Bible prophecy that God said, now, when you see these events transpire, you'll be able to identify that tribe. So we're looking at Ephraim and Manasseh. That's the first two. They're also the biggest, the most important in the family. Remember, this family now had 13 members in the family, and they all went off and had 13 families. And the guy that started all of this was a guy by the name of, you guessed it, Israel. His name was Jacob, and God changed his name to Israel. So his surname then is Israel. He's got two names, Jacob Israel. So easy enough, Jacob Israel. And he had 12 sons. And the two tribes that we're talking about right now, Ephraim and Manasseh, one of his younger boys, the second to the youngest, a guy by the name of Joseph, had two sons. They were named Ephraim and Manasseh. And the birthright blessing which went to Joseph was split between those two. That's why you have 13 tribes. You got 12 sons, but you've got this half tribe. And Ephraim and Manasseh, or one of them is called the half tribe of Manasseh, half tribe. And you've got 13 tribes is what you've got here, 13 individual nations in the world today. And of course, he asked the question, well, where are you going to find these people today? Are they going to be big nations like China or Japan or the United States or Great Britain? Or are they going to be little countries, you know, that are kind of out of the way and out of sight and out of mind, maybe in Jordan or Afghanistan or maybe some offbeat tribes of people down in the Amazon jungle? Where are you going to find these people today? Well, the Bible tells you where you're going to find them, what you're going to be looking for. In order to identify them, you're going to have to identify the characteristics of these people. Now, if you take a look at black people in Africa, they've got certain characteristics. Now, compare those black people in Africa with say Asiatics, and you can see that there's just a world of difference between those two races of people. Well, the various races of people have different characteristics, but you can get down to national characteristics. Like the Japanese are pretty distinct from the Laotians and the Vietnamese and the Chinese and Indonesians and Filipinos and so on. So when you look throughout Asia, you can see that these people not only look different, but they are different. Even though they're all of the same race, they're all Orientals, or they've intermarried with or interbred with Orientals, there are certain characteristics that are very, very different about these people. In fact, they've even got their own wars. You know, the Japanese and the Koreans and the Chinese, you know, have been fighting over that Korean peninsula, you know, for a long time. And the same thing is true in Africa. You know, you look at those people and you say, well, they're all black. Well, they're not all black. And then on top of that, they're all different. Some of them are 7'4", and some of them are pygmies, and they're only about 4 feet tall. You know, some are tall, some are small, and that's the way the characteristics are. Now, the whites are the same way, and what he's identifying here is the different characteristics. Now, you take a look at Canadians and Americans, and you'd say, well, the Canadians and Americans are the same. Well, no, they're not. They're pretty distinct people, have pretty distinct ways of looking at things and acting. And the people of Britain and the people of the United States are very distinct people. They have very distinct and different characteristics, and that's what he's been pointing out here, in case you're joining us a little late, that the English are empire builders and the Americans are not. So if you want to build an empire, you want to side in with the British. They'll do a better job of that. And if you're looking for a place with wide open spaces and a solitary people that kind of mind their own business, the Americans and the Canadians and Australians and the New Zealanders just fit right in there. So the tribes of Manasseh and the tribes, or those tribes that have joined up with Ephraim, have a little different take on international geopolitics, and that's where we're at right now. Now, the prophecy of Isaiah 11, verse 13, has been fulfilled in modern times. While Ephraim, the British, and Judah, the Israelis, have indeed vexed each other, Manasseh, the United States, has had a very favorable relationship with the Israelis. There is one additional factor which identifies the tribe of Ephraim in our modern age, and it constitutes smoking gun evidence. And this evidence is found in the 12th chapter of Judges, which describes a very rare event. It's a battle between the two brother tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. And these events occurred in the aftermath of a war of liberation led by Jephthah against Ammonite oppressors. And in this war, the tribes located in Gilead, the territory of Israel, located east of the Jordan River, bore the full burden of fighting this war. The Gilead tribes consisted of the tribes of Reuben and Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. And after learning about the victory of these Gilead tribes, the tribe of Ephraim became very angry that it had been left out of the battle and victory celebration. An intertribal war ensued. And after Japheth, the leader of the Gilead tribes, indignantly charged that the Ephraimites had actually ignored his plea for help. In response, the Ephraimites attacked the Gilead tribes on the east side of the Jordan River and were defeated. Having lost the battle, the Ephraimites tried to retreat westward across the Jordan River to return to their home territory. However, the Manassites and their allies controlled the river crossings, and they allowed no one to cross unless they could prove that they were not an Ephraimite. Because the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh were brother tribes and were so alike in appearance, a visual inspection could not differentiate between these two tribes and the members thereof. So a unique test was available, however, which was so foolproof that life or death decisions could be made on the basis of this test. And because of the ill will created by the Ephraimites starting this needless armed conflict, the Manassites and their allies were in no mood to allow any Ephraimites to escape alive into their home territory. The events of Judges 12 occurred approximately 1105 B.C. Now, even at that early date, there was a genetically inherited trait which uniquely identified members of the tribe of Ephraim. You read that in Judges 12, verse 6, and it records that all of the suspected Ephraimites were asked to pronounce one particular Hebrew word, Shibboleth. That verse shows that Ephraimites had trouble pronouncing their H's, so they would mistakenly pronounce it Sibboleth instead of Shibboleth. Well, all of those who could not pronounce the word correctly were killed on the spot, and 42,000 Ephraimites died that day. Now, modern readers will note that the concept of due process was not recognized in ancient cultures. So due process and equal protection of the law was a foreign and alien ideology. Now, take a look at the way the British speak. I mean, we call it English. But here in the United States, if you'll take a look around the United States, you can tell when somebody comes from Texas. I can identify those Texans and their peculiar accent. And it's distinct from that southern accent that you will hear in Alabama or Georgia and in North and South Carolina. And you can distinguish people from Pennsylvania in a heartbeat. You can distinguish people from New York City in a heartbeat and those from Massachusetts. Now, just think about that for a moment. Now, listen to somebody from England. You know, they don't go up in an elevator. They take the lift. And they don't open the hood of their car. They look under the bonnet. And they don't put their suitcases in the trunk. They put it in the boot. And they don't go on vacation. They go on holiday. And you'll find that's true also in Canada and Australia. They have these different characteristics. Now, they all speak English. Well, at least we call it English. But you can identify these people and their characteristics by their speech. In fact, in the New Testament, there's a comment that's made about the Apostle Peter, and it said, your speech does betray you. So the accent that somebody has will betray them almost instantly. You can tell when somebody's from California, Washington, or Oregon, as opposed to Texas, Alabama, or Georgia, and in the first sentence that comes out of their mouth, you can say, that guy's not from California, that guy's from Alabama, he's a southerner. You can tell by his drawl. Well, the same thing was true clear back in ancient times. Their speech did betray them. Now, the ability of the victorious Gileadites to make life or death decisions solely on the basis of a person's ability to pronounce one word means that the tendency of Ephraimites to drop their H's was extremely well known back in ancient Israel. The dropping of H's has to be a genetic marker, which is uniquely an Ephraimite trait. Because the Bible recorded this piece of information, we can identify the tribe of Ephraim in the modern world today by locating a nation which is known for dropping their H's in their speech. Now, as many readers surely know, it is the English people of Great Britain who are known for dropping their H's. This genetic trait is so uniquely British that the famous movie and stage production My Fair Lady includes this trait in its storyline. And in this production, a linguistics professor named Henry Higgins experiences exasperation trying to teach a young English female named Eliza Doolittle to pronounce words without dropping her H's. This uniquely English pronunciation quirk identifies the British English people as the tribe of Ephraim in the modern world, and this identification is consistent with all of the other historical and biblical evidence presented in this section, which also identifies the British people of England as the modern tribe of Ephraim. Now, the DNA doesn't lie. It is this author's opinion that God preserved information about this event in the Bible so that this clue would be available to future generations in identifying the whereabouts of the tribe of Ephraim. The United States and Great Britain have long mutually acknowledged a special relationship in international geopolitics and world affairs, and the Bible explains why this relationship exists. Now, the United States of America and the Anglo-Saxon nations of the British Commonwealth are unmistakably the Israelite birthright tribe of Joseph in the modern world today. The United States is Manasseh, and Great Britain and the Saxon Commonwealth nations are Ephraim. If this still sounds surprising, we'll consider the fact that in 1857, two messages were given by a pastor named F.E. Pitts to a joint session of the U.S. Congress. Now, this pastor presented evidence that the United States of America was descended from the 10 tribes of Israel, and Pastor Pitts had little of the information presented in this book available to him. So he based his conclusion on Bible prophecies alone. Now, here's what Pitts wrote. He said, quote, "The United States of America, our great country, is foretold in the Holy Scriptures. The United States of America is the nationality that is promised in the prophetic scriptures to arise in the latter times as Israel restored. Such was ancient Israel, and such is the United States of America today." Unquote. Now, Pitts thought that America by itself constituted latter-day Israel, and that the 13 colonies represented the 13 tribes of ancient Israel, and he also applied verse 8 of Isaiah 66, which is an end-time prophecy, about a nation born at once, to the United States of America, which was born at once on July 4, 1776, in the Declaration of Independence. Now, the above shows how radically that the social and political environment has changed in America over the past century. Now, can you imagine today, in the Congress of the United States, convening a joint session dedicated to the themes of Bible prophecy and America's Israelite origin? The fact that the United States Congress received evidence in the 19th century that the United States was descended from the 10 tribes of Israel shows that the conclusions of this book are hardly unprecedented. However, being true to its Manasseh heritage, the American leadership of the 19th century quickly forgot about its Israelite heritage. Now, while the United States of America and the British nations constitute the nations of Ephraim and Manasseh in the modern world, one caveat should be noted. Now, due to the massive immigration of many Europeans, America surely is now home to contingents of all of the tribes of Israel, and also due to the more recent influx of many non-Europeans into America and the British nations, their citizens now include many non-hereditary Israelites. All right, now that concludes the first section here on Ephraim and Manasseh. All right, so if you're keeping score here, write that down on your list. You might want to keep track of it if you don't have a book here that you can refer to from time to time. I have a hard time. I can remember several of them, but there's three or four of them, you know, that kind of get out of my sights a little bit. So write down Ephraim, that's the British people, and then Manasseh, the tribe or the country of the United States. Now let's take a look at Reuben. Now Reuben was the firstborn son of Israel. Israel had four wives, by the way. He had two wives, Leah and Rachel. That's his first two. They had two handmaids. And he took those as wives called concubines. Now, there's a little misunderstanding that a lot of people have as a matter of law. A concubine is a wife. The distinction between a wife and a concubine is that the children of a concubine do not inherit. It's the children of the wives who inherit. And under the inheritance law, we find that the firstborn son receives a double portion. Double portion. That's because he becomes the new patriarch of the clan or the family. When dad dies, the firstborn son assumes that role, takes on that mantle. And under Israelite law, the patriarch of a family has the entire duty of providing for the entire clan, the entire family. So let me give you a little illustration of that as we progress, because this guy, Reuben, was disinherited. You'll notice that the birthright went to Joseph, who was the firstborn son of Rachel, the second wife. And Joseph should not have inherited the birthright. That birthright belonged to Reuben. But Reuben did something here, as we progress along, we'll find out, that disqualified him as an inheritor. And so he has been demoted, is what it boils down to. But under the law, the firstborn has to take care of all the rest of the family. So to give you an illustration, I'm the patriarch of the Gordon family, or the Gordon clan, and I had a daughter here who married, and she divorced. Well, when she divorced, a question arises, who takes care of her and her children? She goes back to her father's house, puts on her widow's garments, and then she lives off of the old man. That's what it boils down to, and I took care of her for 2 years until she remarried. Now, when you marry, you take that liability. That's the purpose for a marriage ceremony. It's a public recitation. It's an acknowledgement that there is a legal transformation occurring here, that the benefits that this female is entitled to and the liabilities that attach to her are now being transferred from this family to another family. And that's because every female in Israel has to be taken care of from the cradle to the grave. That's, after all, what every woman wants. That's why we have welfare and food stamps and all these government programs over here. It's because females have a security obsession. They have to be secure. They have to have a nest. They're called nest builders. Men don't have that same proclivity. Men are very happy investing everything that they've got in a gold mine in the Pacific Trench. They don't have any qualms about that at all. Females, on the other hand, want to make sure that their investments are 100% safe. So they want to invest in treasury bills, you know, short-term treasury bills and things like that. Well, this guy Reuben over here, who was entitled to that birthright, disqualified himself. That birthright then went to the firstborn son of the second wife. So it shows you that there is an order here in the inheritance law. When a female leaves her family, she takes her dowry or her bride price with her. That's her inheritance. And her inheritance changes, and that's why a female takes the name of her husband. Her inheritance changes to her husband's family. Now, there's an exception to that, and you're observing that today with the Windsors, the royal family in Great Britain. Queen Elizabeth's last name is in reality Saxe-Gotha. She's from the tribe of Judah. She's a Jew. She's a descendant from King David. She's a Pharaoh's line Jew. And her name was changed to Windsor during World War I when the British were at war with the Germans. That name didn't sound too good, so they changed it to Windsor. Well, in the ensuing years, when Queen Elizabeth took the throne back in 1953, she's a female. And the inheritance, that is the Windsor family estate, is in the process of being transferred to the succeeding generation, which in this case is Prince Charles, who will someday become King Charles. And then he has a firstborn son. Now, this occurs once in a while, and there is a special provision in the inheritance law to cover this. And what's happening here is the female who married a fellow by the name of Mountbatten, does not take the name Mountbatten, but keeps her family name Windsor. So that young fellow isn't named Charles Mountbatten. His name is Charles Windsor. And what you're witnessing here is the transfer of the family estate from one generation to the next through a female who keeps her maiden name. It's an unusual event, doesn't occur too often, but you'll see it twice in the genealogy of the Messiah in Matthew 1 and Luke, I believe it is 3. All right, here's the tribe of Reuben, the passionate firstborn. Reuben was the eldest son of Jacob, and his descendants would ordinarily have received the birthright blessings of the Abrahamic covenant. We learn much about Reuben in Genesis 37, verses 12 through 35. When his younger brothers were intent on killing Joseph, Reuben intervened to prevent it. Now, the Bible relates that Reuben did not participate in or consent to selling Joseph into slavery either, but had intended to return Joseph safely to Jacob's custody. Now, while this account confirms good intentions on Reuben's part, it also shows a weak point, that although Reuben's goal of rescuing Joseph was admirable, he lacked the follow-through to implement his worthy goal. And inexplicably, Reuben wandered away from an urgent crisis that required his full attention. And even though Reuben was the oldest son and did not participate in the plot against Joseph, he did join his brother's conspiracy of the deception in telling Jacob that a lion had killed Joseph. Now, this characteristic, or this trait of indecision, of personal character weakness, will be found in a country somewhere that genetically, the DNA doesn't lie, that genetically you're going to find this characteristic or this weakness of indecision and vicissitude, is it? Or vacillation, I guess it is, vacillation in a group of people. Looking around the world in Anglo-Saxon countries, where would you find a group of people like that? Well, hang on with that Burma Shave commercial, and we will be right back as soon as I give you a reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And that also can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School Direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not necessarily mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're back with Israel's Tribes Today. Let me give you a name and number here. This guy, Stephen Collins, is a pretty good old boy. I'm going to give you his address here. If you'd like to order all five of these books, he sent me all five of them, postage paid, for a $100 bill. So I think if you were to write him and say you heard this on the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and send him a $100 bill, I'm pretty sure he'd send you all five of these books. And you might just tell him, hey, please sign them for me too, would you? He signed mine. He says, to George Gordon with my compliments, Stephen Collins. This guy might someday be very famous, and if he is, I've got one of his signed books. How's that? I've got five of them. The five books, The Lost Tribes of Israel Found, Israel's Tribes Today, The Origin and Empires of Ancient Israel, Israel's Lost Empires, and Parthia. are the five books, and he's writing a sixth right now. I talked to him not too long ago. I told him I was going to do this last book. I was going to review it. And he's writing a sixth book, which will deal with ancient history, not just the Israelites, but ancient history from the perspective of the Bible, the pre-flood period. Now, I brought you a series here not too long ago from a book called The Genesis Flood. So if you'd like to learn more about that, there's a neat book out here called The Genesis Flood. I covered that one. You can get the name and number for that. But this guy's address is 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. Guy's name, again, is Collins, C-O-L-L-I-N-S, Stephen M. Collins. And his address is 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. Now, the reason I say send a $100 bill is that these five books are just absolutely the finest dissertation on the tribes of Israel that I've seen, bar none, anywhere. And I've got a library here that's got many, many books on heraldry and Celtic history and in plain sight and America B.C. I mean, I've looked into this quite a bit, and Israel and British Israelism and all these various and sundry ancillary subjects that go along with it. And this guy, by far and away, is head and shoulders above all of them. Everybody's written a little bit. This guy puts it together in a story flow that is just phenomenal. Remember that name again, Stephen M. Collins, 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. And if you want to order one book at a time, I'm sure Mr. Collins doesn't want to sell you a book at a time, BibleBlessings.net. Just go to the website, BibleBlessings.net. That's the publishing house. Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. Maybe you don't want to spend $100 and buy all five. You just want to buy one book. Say you want Israel's Tribes Today. That's his latest book. I imagine it's around $20. Go to the webpage and ask him. It's P.O. Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. That would be my guess. It's about a $20 bill. They might charge you shipping and handling, too. I don't know. All right, we're talking about this guy named Reuben, the tribes of Israel. Well, many years later, when the brothers felt guilty about their cruelty toward Joseph, Reuben chimed in, with an I told you so comment in Genesis 42, verses 18 through 23. And this account confirms Reuben's good intentions. But it also indicates his lack of determination to act on those good intentions. And the above accounts indicate that Reuben preferred to coexist grudgingly with something that he opposed, instead of confronting that evil by himself. Now, Judges chapter 5 records an episode in which some of the Israelite tribes under Deborah and Barak defeated their Canaanite oppressors. This chapter records a song of Deborah and Barak in which several Israelite tribes are chided for declining to participate in the battle. In Judges 5, verses 15 and 16, it states that the Reubenites had great searchings of heart, but did not come to the battle. Now, this echoes forefather Reuben's tendency to have good intentions that do not get translated into actions. However, as we will see later, this is only a tendency and not an ironclad trait of Reuben. The tribe of Reuben, at a critical point in the history of Western Europe, did act decisively and likely tipped the scales to save Western Europe. That episode will be discussed later, and it may have been the Reubenites' finest hour. Well, Reuben had great physical appetites, and he had difficulty controlling his sexual urges, as we see in Genesis 35, verse 22. And it tells us that Reuben committed adultery with Bilhah, his father's concubine. She was the mother of Reuben's own half-brothers, Dan and Naphtali. Reuben's affair created severe stress in Jacob's family. In Genesis 49, verses 3 and 4, it records that this episode moved Jacob to transfer the birthright promises from Leah's firstborn son, Reuben, to Rachel's firstborn son, Joseph. Adultery, per se, may not have lost him the birthright. However, it was, let's see, where am I here, Rachel's firstborn son, by committing adultery with his father's concubine, Reuben had usurped his father's prerogatives. And it is this author's opinion that if Reuben had committed adultery with a woman not bound to his father, he would not have lost his birthright. Biblical precedent supports this view. King David was promised an eternal dynasty by God, the birthright promise given to the tribe of Judah in Genesis 49:10. David, the Judahite, who received his birthright promise, committed one of the most famous acts of adultery in all of history when he took Bathsheba. Did God cancel David's birthright? The answer to that is no. God punished David, but he did not annul the birthright promise of eternal dynasty. And the ancient Reubenites lived in Gilead, east of the Jordan River, along with the tribe of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh. They were carried into an Assyrian or Asian captivity by the Assyrians years before the fall of Samaria, as we read in 2 Kings 10:33 and 2 Kings 15:29 and 1 Chronicles 5, verse 26. When Assyria's empire fell, the liberated Israelites migrated northward into southern Russia, and we have no specific word of the Reubenites after their exit from ancient Israel. However, we can infer what happened to their tribe. When the Massagetae and the allied Saki tribes moved from the Caspian Sea region into the eastern portion of Parthia's empire, they resettled in Sakistan. Since the Reubenites were with the Manassites in Gilead and both went into captivity in Asia at the same time, they're most likely allied to the Manassite portion of the Massagetae and constituted one of the allied Saki tribes. As discussed in the previous book on Parthian history, there may be a clue to the Reubenites' presence with the Massagetae. Now, one of the major clans of the Reubenites was called the Carmi, C-A-R-M-I, as we read in Numbers 26, verses 5 and 6. The Massagetae were called to the Chorasmi, C-H-O-R-A-S-M-I-I, Chorasmi, I guess that is, Chorasmi, no A in there, Chorasmi. Note the similarity between Carmi and Chorasmi, or Chorasmi. When the Parthians and Scythians migrated into Europe in search of new homelands, the Reubenites would have been present among the waves of Caucasian people who poured into Europe from Asia. Now, to identify the Reubenites, we must rely on the clues of the prophecy in Genesis 49, verses 3 and 4. As we read about this tribe in the latter days, it states, quote, "Reuben, you are my firstborn, preeminent in pride and preeminent in power, unstable as water. You shall not have preeminence because you went up to your father's bed. Then you defiled it." Now, several things are readily apparent. While Reuben will have pride and power in the latter days, it will not have the same preeminence over the other tribes because it had lost the birthright to Joseph. The Reubenites will be volatile. They will be emotional people. The phrase "unstable as water" is rendered "boiling over like water" in the Amplified version of the Bible. Since Reuben's lack of sexual restraint is again cited in this latter-day prophecy, the Reubenites will be known for loose sexual practices in the modern world. Now, what nation in modern Europe has substantial power and pride, but has less power than the English or the Americans, is very volatile, very emotional, and is famous for its physical and sexual appetites? France immediately comes to mind. After the English and the Americans, the French are the next strongest nation in the Western Alliance. A nuclear power, France became a populous nation and also had a substantial colonial empire of its own. France has historically been one of the more powerful nations in Europe's history. Even today, the French have military power second only to that of the United States and Britain, and the leaders of the Western Alliance. The French have a tradition of military power, as Napoleon was one of the world's greatest generals, conquering much of Europe. As he led his forces all the way to Moscow, the French have regularly contended with the British and the Germans for the leadership role in Europe. France has fulfilled the prophecy about being a powerful nation among the tribes of modern Israel. The Reubenite pride of Genesis 49 is translated as dignity in the King James Version. Either definition characterizes the French. The French are known as a proud people who strive to preserve French culture and the French language against a dominant tide of Anglo-Saxon culture. France even has laws to protect the French culture and language from the intrusion of English words. Even in Canada, the French Canadians in Quebec have implemented special laws to preserve the French language and culture against English dominance. Much dignity is apparent in such impressive French institutions as the Versailles Palace, the Louvre, the Eiffel Tower, and the Cathedral of Notre Dame. The French are famous for their emotional volatility, and the term French, hang on a second here. The French leave is a euphemism found in dictionaries for any hasty, unauthorized departure. French leave. For much of the 20th century, the French exhibited great instability in their nation, changing governments at an incredible rate. The Encyclopedia Americana has noted that during the 70 years of the Third Republic, from 1875 to 1945, more than 100 cabinets succeeded one another in France, with an average tenure in office of less than 8 months. The main cause of ministerial instability was the lack of disciplined parties. Constitutional life under the Fourth Republic, that is 1946 to 1958, came to resemble that under the Third Republic. The average lifespan of governments was shorter than the Third Republic. Even a modern encyclopedia describes the French with the same term, instability, that Genesis 49 uses to describe the Reubenites in the latter days as being unstable as water. Paris is famous both as a city of culture and a city of romance, linking the dignity and the sensuality of Reuben. The word French has become a synonym for passion and physical appetite. It is a common adjective for nouns associated with sensuality and eroticism. French perfume, French kisses, French films, French cut fashions, and so forth. The Parisian Follies Bergère and other similar shows are some of the world's most famous sensuous productions. There is a cultural difference between the British-American viewpoint on sexual infidelity and the French viewpoint. American and British leaders can be brought down or severely weakened by sexual scandals. But if French leaders are revealed to have illegitimate children or mistresses, the reaction of the French nation typically is, so what's the big deal? The Reubenites are a people associated with satisfying the physical appetites for food and drink as well. Gourmet food and drink have long been associated with French chefs, French cuisine, and French Grand Cru wines. A reputation for refinement and excellence in food and drink are part of the dignity as well as the appetite of Reuben. The French have a passion for enjoying life. And I might also point out that the French colonized New Orleans, and New Orleans is the hotbed of sexual licentiousness in America, and also of food and cuisine. And we always talk about the French Quarter of New Orleans. And we talk about the Mardi Gras and the licentious behavior. And we talk about the Louisiana or the New Orleans food. They have a very unusual variety, not only just unusual foods, but a great variety of them. And New Orleans was founded by the French, of course. Now, in Deuteronomy 33, verse 6, Moses gave this prophecy about the tribe of Reuben. He said, let Reuben live and not die, and let not his men be few. This prophecy indicates that the Reubenites will not be few. There will be, after the birthright tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, one of the largest tribes of Israel. France fits that description, as it is one of the largest and most populous nations of Europe. France's rivalry with England for supremacy in Europe during the Napoleonic and other wars further indicates that France is Reuben, even as forefather Reuben did not willingly yield the birthright promise to forefather Joseph. The French did not willingly yield leadership of Europe to the Anglo-Saxons either. If the French had prevailed over the English in their wars, France would have been inherited, or would have inherited, the bulk of the birthright blessings. Although biblical prophecy decreed that most of the blessings of Abraham's birthright blessings would belong to Joseph's descendants, Ephraim and Manasseh, the Reubenites did not give up without a long, bloody fight. When America was fighting its Revolutionary War against the British, the role of France was a decisive factor. So seen in a biblical perspective, Manasseh, America, achieved independence from Ephraim, England, only with the assistance of Brother Reuben in France. Now, France displayed a Reubenite trait in World War II. When pressured by Nazi might, France yielded and chose to coexist with the Nazi evil by way of the Vichy government rather than to continue the war along with the British. Forefather Reuben yielded to brotherly pressure in lying to their father about Joseph's fate instead of opposing what he knew to be wrong. So, too, the French grudgingly cooperated with the Nazis rather than continuing to oppose what they knew to be wrong. In contrast, Great Britain, Ephraim, declared that they would doggedly fight on alone rather than surrender to a great evil. Prime Minister Winston Churchill declared that England would never surrender, and even declared that the English would carry on the fight against the Nazis from new bases in the British Empire if England itself should fall. And even though France also had an empire and a powerful fleet to help carry on the war against the Nazis, France declined to use those assets to pursue the war. On the other hand, the French could truthfully argue that they did not enjoy the luxury of the English Channel acting as a national moat for the British to hold back the Nazis. However, France's collaborationist Vichy government and its refusal to allow the French Empire and the French fleet to continue to oppose the Nazis exhibited the tendency of forefather Reuben to coexist with evil instead of opposing it. Now, earlier it was mentioned that decisive action by the tribe of Reuben may have saved Western Europe. That episode occurred centuries before our modern era, when many Germanic and Gothic tribes were migrating into Europe from Asia after Parthia fell. The tribe known as the Franks settled in France. Now, the Franks gave their name to modern France. The previous chapter discussed the invasion of Europe by Attila and his Huns. Well, Attila's Huns had conquered their way through Eastern and Central Europe, and they were invading Western Europe. The Visigoths, Saxons, Germans, Burgundians, and the Goths had been pushed as far westward as they could go. They combined to fight Attila's Huns at a pivotal battle of Chalon, located east of Paris. The Western army was led by a Roman general named Aetius, who had been born as a member of the Vandal tribe. He was assisted by King Theodoric of the Visigoths, and the forces of Aetius and Theodoric lifted the siege of Orleans and then prepared to fight the entire force of the Huns near Chalon. And the Encyclopedia Britannica says of this pivotal event that one night before the battle, whose Franks, who favored Aetius, broke through to him after a slaughter of 15,000 men. Now, in the year 451, Attila marched west at the head of an enormous host of Huns, and they overran the south of Germany. So it was the French then, in this pivotal battle back in the Middle Ages, that made the difference between Europe being European or being Asiatic. Well, we're about out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll come back and we'll take up more on this tribe and of Reuben. We'll finish the job next time when we come back to Israel's tribes today. Let me give you the guy's name one more time. It's Stephen M. Collins. Stephen Collins. Get his number here in my Rolodex. 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. Again, that's Stephen Collins, 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. If you want all five books, send him a $100 bill. That's what I did. And I got all five of them. I got them autographed. Be sure to put in there that you want to have them autographed. If you just want to buy one book at a time, go to the BibleBlessings.net website. BibleBlessings.net. If you want to buy one at a time. All right, we're about out of time. Let me give you a final reminder, and we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.